You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Today is Monday, March 18th, 2024, and I'm very fortunate today to be here with Professor David Beto. David is a professor emeritus of history from the University of Alabama and also a senior fellow at the Independent Institute in California. And we're here to talk with David today about his new book, The New Deal's War on the Bill and the Bill of Rights, on the Bill of Rights. David, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me. This is a pleasure.
So, David, we go back quite a bit, and I wanted to address a couple background issues with you before we get to the new book, which is, could you describe how you got interested in classical liberal ideas in the first place and your experience as a graduate student in the field of history as a classical liberal during that time?
Well, as you said, I go way back, and my interest really began, I don't know, before I was 20, maybe around when I was, well, no, when I was in high school. I got introduced to the ideas through a book called It Usually Begins with Ayn Rand, which was a book by Jerome Tuchilli. It happened to be in my high school library. And I just started reading this and I thought, this is, you know, this is interesting. And of course, Tuchilli had an irreverent view of Rand. So then I later ended up reading Rand's novels and I appreciated them in a certain context. I still appreciate them, but I didn't get introduced on that kind of basis. I got introduced on kind of a libertarian basis that was sort of a, you know, he was sort of a skeptic. He was kind of a guy that was a little irreverent. And so it was a nice way to be introduced. And from there, I started reading people he cited, like Milton Friedman and Murray Rothbard and others. So it's a forgotten book now, I think, but it was very important for me in kind of directing me on this course and getting more and more interested in the ideas. And then I touched base with Institute for Humane Studies and Walter Grinder when I got in graduate school. Very helpful, giving me ideas. And I went to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin at Madison in history. And at that time, so I've been told it's worse now, it was pre-political correctness, whatever you want to call it, right? And I found that actually my contrarian ideas, and I think that's how they regarded me, were probably to my advantage, probably helped me. And there were professors that liked that because they got bored with everybody just sort of saying the same thing. And here I was coming, you know, sometimes being an asshole, bringing up stuff that I'd read at, you know, Conceived in Liberty or whatever, you know, and they thought, oh, you know, that's interesting. And as I became a professor years later, I sort of kept that in mind when I had students. They kind of came out of left field, which, as you know, doesn't happen very often at all.
Were you a classmate with Nancy McLean?
I was, and by about a year. And I remember her being regarded as kind of a young superstar. There was a meeting where all the students were sitting around her, and they were kind of hushed, like, Nancy McLean is here. So she had that reputation. I didn't really know her, though. I mean, I think she'd remember me, but we really didn't have much in the way of contact, conversation. We certainly knew a lot of the same people. And she would have had a lot of the same professors. And that's one thing I was pointing out, that some of the professors I had and she probably had, like Al Bogue, who was actually did stuff for the Volcker Fund back in the 50s, they would not have appreciated her tendency to cut corners and her tendency to take quotations out of context and that kind of thing. That was something Bogue hammered into us. So she had a very good graduate school education, if, you know, to the extent she had the same people I had. And so, you know, I think she's not living up to that education, to the standards that were set by a lot of those people.
You know, it's a shame, actually, in that regard. The second point that I wanted to address with you was one of your early books, because I believe your dissertation was on the tax revolts. And then you did another book. You wrote this critical review article and then developed it in, you know, into a book and everything. And it was on this issue of mutual aid societies. And one of the themes of the work that we do at the Hayek Program is in terms of research and education in the robustness of civil society as a foundation for self-governing democratic societies. And obviously, this work that you did on mutual aid societies is a classic work about the robustness of civil society. I love, even to this day, I remember it like the first time I read it, the comparison you have about the fraternal coverage of health insurance versus health insurance like later on in the second half of the 20th century among minority groups and stuff. If you could just outline a few of the basics of the argument you develop in that book, I think our audience would appreciate it.
Well, let me say the book came out of a gentleman we both know named Tom Palmer and also Walter Grinder when I was at the Institute for Humane Studies. And Tom, and I said, I saw this very interesting book by David Green on the British, and then he also wrote on the Australian Friendly Societies. He said, gee, I wonder, you know, here I'm studying history, I don't even know this. I wonder if anything like this existed in the United States. And so I started looking into it, you know, sort of on Tom's suggestion, I guess, in a way, or encouragement, and found that there was a very rich tradition, somewhat different. And these were groups that they were organized in lodges. Sometimes they'd have thousands of lodges. They would have rituals, which were often served a kind of function of building a kind of solidarity. And they would provide benefits for people who were sick, cash benefits. And then they also started to provide lodge doctors, where they would have doctors would go and they would bid for contracts of local fraternal societies, and they'd be paid on a kind of flat fee. And you could get house calls and all sorts of things, right? For like $1, $2 a year, which even if you were to, you know, do your inflation calculator, say 1910 versus now, that's not much money. So, you know, that was a fascinating story. And you found these groups among, you know, a very high percentage of the population. You found them especially among immigrants and among African Americans. And that whole story of African-American lodges, which has been noticed but usually made fun of in things like Amos and Andy, was just pervasive. People would almost joke about it, how the lodge was so important and how insurance ownership rates were amazing. On a group that has 50% or more poverty rates, they had 90% of families or more had life insurance policies, admittedly small ones, but that took a lot to keep paying those policies. And they belonged to a lot of lodges as well. So that story still hasn't been told adequately. I try to tell part of the story, but there are whole books that could be done on this that have not been done. And there's all sorts of primary source material out there. It's still a neglected topic.
Yeah, it's a great research topic because it demonstrates, you know, not just the robustness of civil society, but it addresses a fundamental question that we'll get now to your new book on FDR by first talking about one of the great, you know, centralizers, which is in one of Lincoln's addresses. He says that government should do those things that and only those things that private citizens cannot do for themselves or cannot do well for themselves. And government can do well for, you know, do provide it well. And part of the whole thing of the mutual aid society, I think, is to demonstrate that even though we think these vulnerable groups can't do these things, they have tremendous robustness and the ability to provide that. And I think your book did an amazing job of showing that. And when we don't study those things, we end up by thinking that the only way in which we could resolve these very difficult problems is to have the federal government or the local government take over and do it. And so I think that that research program of yours is, you know, phenomenal, and you set the thing. And I hope, you know, students that are out there listening decide to do research, original primary research on those things as well.
Yeah. Oh, and if they want to contact me, I could make suggestions. And, you know, historians for many years, they just would look at private charity or government charity, and they wouldn't look at this vast mutual aid network. And a lot of this is churches, for example. We don't know. That's very common, where the local church will rebuild someone's home after a fire. And that, we have, none of that is written down. I mean, a lot of informal mutual aid was out there. That really hasn't been studied very well either, right? But it's everywhere. And again, you got a society where you've got 40% poverty rates and government is spending like 1% of GDP on social welfare. Private social charity is also very minimal. So how do people survive, right? How do they move forward? And this mutual aid tradition is a big part of it, and we need more work on it.
All right, well, let's get to your most recent book about FDR and the New Deal and its impact or assault on our on the Bill of Rights. So first, you know, why is FDR held up as such a great president when his track record on economic policy as well as civil liberties is actually quite questionable? And can you give an example of the interconnectedness between economic and political freedom, for example, in your work that shows that, you know, when FDR's assault on our Bill of Rights also is interconnected to his assault on the private sector of the economy?
Well, certainly FDR wants to get reelected, and he wants to discredit critics of the New Deal. And this is a central driver in this. So, for example, a committee that FDR recruited called the Black Committee, which was a congressional committee, Senate committee, chaired by Hugo Black, looked at 3 million private telegrams without a subpoena and used that information against witnesses. What is motivating that? Well, a good part of what's motivating that is to discredit political opponents. So I would say that what is the main driver of this? I think the good of the New Deal, FDR staying in political power, undermining political opponents, and of course, FDR's own political self-interest. But we make a mistake if we dismiss FDR as just a vote seeker, because I think I've listened to all of FDR's recorded speeches. I don't know how I did it, but I did. And the man is driven by ideology. There's no doubt about it. Now, he's a pragmatic politician as well, and he'll back off if he has to. But his view is the market failed. You know, government is the only solution. They screwed us up. They got us into this Great Depression by, you know, leaving the market alone. We need a welfare state. And he's driving in that direction. And it's for ideological reasons. And it makes sense when you look at his background in a lot of ways and his influences.
So, I mean, I'll come back to the issue because one of the things is the messenger matters, and he's an extremely charismatic and charming messenger for the time. But I want to ask a kind of a meta question, which is about, you know, basically historians and economic historians. So they have a hard time sometimes talking to each other. And I want to give an example of this, which is that, and it's someone who I knew when I lived in New York, and I respect tremendously, Ira Katznelson. And Ira Katznelson wrote a book about the New Deal as well called Fear Itself, right? And basically, and if you read the book, one of the things that's fascinating about it is that he takes the intentions of the policies, and that's what he focuses on, not the consequences of the policies. So there's no data in the book. There's no like, oh, in FDR, in order to fight the Great Depression, did X, Y, and Z. What was the consequences of that on economic performance through time, right? And so to an economist studying these things, you know, you come in, you want to look, let's say I'm a Keynesian economist, I want to look at the impact of the multiplier on whether or not government spending had generated this with employment or whatever. And, you know, and I get frustrated because the reality is that the policies throughout the 1930s did not, you know, reverse the economic fortunes, right? And so it raises challenge. Even we challenge the idea, the claim that the war got us out of the Great Depression, right? Christina Romer studies, you know, the impact of the war spending on the multiplier and doesn't estimate it to be the kind of numbers there. So you're someone who's actually, you know, quite aware of economics. not just because of Rothbard. I think if my memory is right, I think didn't you do a subfield in political economy as part of your studies at Wisconsin?
Yeah, you're right about that. I did do that. And not under a libertarian, that's for sure.
Right. And so you're familiar with this. And I just kind of, if you think about it, like, how do you see the kind of interrelationship between the book that you're writing here and the, say, a book by like Amity Schlaes, which is more of a popular history about the economic policies that were going on?
Well, the whole question of intentions is a good question to ask, because I find all sorts of information, and it's out there. And other people pointed out that there is a ruthless and a sadistic and a heartless quality to FDR. There's a movie done many years ago. It was about J. Edgar Hoover, and it starred Treat Williams as J. Edgar Hoover. And they had that guy named David Ogden Stiers in it, who was in MASH, played FDR, perfect FDR. But it was a rarity because it was a critical treatment. And Hoover's objecting to Japanese internment, and the FDR character says, "Mr. Hoover, in Washington, all power flows to the center, and I am the center." I about fell out of my chair when I saw this, but I thought that captured FDR. I mean, he wanted to force people off the air. Publicly, he would be somebody that would talk about free speech, but he would use any method necessary. The Japanese internment, which, first of all, I think the standard story is wrong in a lot of ways. I don't think he was forced into it. That's sort of what you get in the mainstream literature. And that's the same excuse given for his neglect of African-Americans. But, he kept them in those camps all the way through the 1944 election, when his leading advisors were saying, "Look, Mr. President, we can release them now. The bad time is over with." And FDR is like, there's a cold-hearted aspect to him. And Harry Truman even had a quotation where he called him the coldest man I ever met. So when we get into this issue of intention, we might want to try to unpack those a little bit. Yes, he's a man of ideas. Yes, he's ideological. But there's a ruthlessness there, a self-seeking aspect to him, a kind of cruelty there that I think these historians need to be introduced to. And they need to be introduced to examples of this, because they're out there. There are many, many of them. They need to square that argument where, how he's not this necessarily the humanitarian that he's made out to be, if you look at the whole record. So I think that's a good part of this. And that's one of the things I think, if somebody reads the book, they're going to come away saying, "Gee, I didn't know he did that," I would think. And they're going to want to at least look at it and see if I've got a case. I don't think he comes out of this unscathed, because I think the data, the information is there.
Yeah, let me dig in a little bit to that, because you already mentioned the Black, committee, and there's a certain legacy of that, even though there's an aspect, it's kind of like the attempt to pack the Supreme Court, which is it might have failed, but it ends up by having a legacy of all the proposals for the New Deal after that all get accepted. It generates a unanimity kind of idea. The Black Committee ends up by doing, as you mentioned, these surveillance, unleashes the surveillance state on us. And we have a legacy of that. But then you follow that up with a variety of other case studies. These are your chapters, including the way they tried to handle and censor the radio and whatnot. And so maybe you can give the listeners a little bit of a feel about the sort of magnitude of all of these efforts to attack the Bill of Rights, basically.
Well, we could start with radio, because FDR is a master of using radio. In fact, it was said that if he had not been a professional politician, he could have thrived as a radio commentator. He had the voice for it. He knew how to use it. Hoover didn't. Hoover's inept. FDR knows how to use it. And through various methods, and if you look at the Twitter files and you look at things like that, it all seems a precursor to that. They use behind-the-scene methods. They use subtle pressure from the FCC, from the networks, putting pressure on them and so forth. And through those methods, by 1938, there is not one remaining anti-New Deal radio commentator on the networks by 1938. Not one left. Now, contrast that with the print press. The print press was always against FDR. He said 90%, you know, it was more like 60%, but it was a lot. They didn't, you know, they were against him. And he would rail against fake news and all of that. He sounded like Donald Trump in a lot of ways, but radio was his domain. And he's able to use these various methods to force dissenting voices off the wall. Early version of the equal time rule. A lot of networks just say, well, we're not going to let dissenting voices on. That'll be very, very costly because we'll have to provide a different voice and that kind of thing. So that's one example. You're asking about censorship?
Yeah. Well, in fact, just more in general, I mean, even like the other commissions that were formed, you know, like I said, you go through the various case studies. And as you pointed out before, it's just that, you know, FDR is very difficult for him to come out of your book unscathed. But it's just the sheer magnitude of the state that is growing at this time, even before the war. So you can't use it as like, you know, oh, we need to do all that because the war is going on. It happens, you know, even as you said, 1939, he eliminates, you know, the sort of dissenters, right?
Well, there's another, there's a successor to the Black Committee. When Black is nominated for the Supreme Court, which is frankly, the reason Black is nominated is because he is a very ruthless, very effective partisan. And FDR has no inclination that, you know, he's going to be a civil libertarian or anything like that. The Klan membership, I think, was well known to him. It came out publicly, but I don't think it was a big deal to him. But Sherman Minton, a senator from Indiana, replaces Black. And Minton now can't do private telegrams because part of the story I tell is there's a lot of pushback against FDR, including a lot of pushback from New Dealers. And so this, if you're on the left and you read my book, you're going to find plenty of good guys, you know, good women in defending civil liberties that would agree with you on economic issues. So Minton doesn't have that. He doesn't have that. He gets very frustrated and eventually does a lot of things which are in the book, but he gets so frustrated, he proposes a bill. I don't have proof of this, but I think FDR suggested it to him, but I don't have proof of it, but I have reason to think that he did. And it's all in line with FDR's war against fake news. And Minton's bill would have made it a felony for a newspaper to publish any article known to be false. And it sounds like something Donald Trump proposed a few years ago. And Minton is like stunned by the pushback. Just about all of his colleagues in the Senate say, even on the left, say, no, that's ridiculous. He's belittled for that and he loses re-election. He has to withdraw the bill ignominiously. FDR is asked about Minton's bill, and this is already as this public, you know, pressure is coming, and FDR jokes about it. He said, well, you know, if we were to enact this bill, you know, we wouldn't have room in the federal prison system for all the guilty people that would have to be put there. And then he ends with a little quip, and he said, you boys brought it on yourselves, you know. And okay, that's interesting. And again, the story is Minton had somebody in the executive branch suggest the bill to him, but I don't have the hard evidence, unfortunately. But in any case, this is another example of this. And Minton has to withdraw it, though, because there is all this opposition. There's a story here about African-Americans. I know one of your people is asking about that. And if you're interested in African-American history, there's a lot of new material in here, at least new material that, I mean, other historians have written about it, but it really hasn't been written by in a big way, right? It's not stuff that would make it into the textbooks. And I give an example there of a political boss named Crump, who was an ally of FDR, ran Memphis top to bottom. And Crump had an active Republican opposition. And the opposition was led by African-Americans. The chair of the Republican Party in Memphis was African-American. They could vote there. And Crump doesn't like this. He's a big ally of Roosevelt. He's gotten tons of money from Roosevelt. He was a supporter of Roosevelt from 1931 on. So he's like an original guy. And Crump just says to this guy, this Black Republican, who's doing these rallies for Wilkie right before the election that gets 1,000 people, Black and white, and he hopes to carry the state for Wilkie, had gone Republican in the 20s. He essentially sends the police out to this guy, and they start searching every single customer going into his drugstore, including school children. This goes on and on and on. He basically forces this guy out of the city with the threat of the work going into the workhouse. This guy, by the way, is the head of the Republican Party. He's African-American. He's head of the National Negro Baseball League. He built the stadium, the main stadium for Black baseball players in Memphis. He's a big guy, but he's a big Republican. And he comes back one time in 1943. He goes to his stadium to watch a game. The police arrest him and tell him to get out of the city. A. Philip Randolph, the labor leader, who's quite a civil libertarian, by the way, quite a good one in my set, goes to FDR, goes to Eleanor Roosevelt, and is rebuffed. And it's quite clear, people have written about this, that they're not going to do anything about Crump, because Crump is a very loyal ally of the administration. And so even though this is extremely blatant, what's going on here, nothing happens. So those are a few examples. And then I also talk in there about censorship of the wartime press, which is a little bit more, there's a little bit more to that than you might expect. And of course, Japanese internment is a big part of the book. I call Japanese internment, in terms of civil liberties, a big puzzle piece. I say these are all puzzle pieces. They fit together. That's the big one, but it fits with the other ones. So it's part of a general record going back to when FDR was Assistant Secretary of the Navy under Wilson. An attitude. The means, the ends justify any means necessary to achieve. And that's a strain of progressivism. There's a civil libertarian strain. He does not buy that. FDR will do what it takes. And I'm not being unfair to him, because I have example after example here.
No, you do. The book is really outstanding in terms of the original, you know, research that you engaged in doing the book. I guess, if you could talk a little bit more about, because FDR's issue with the Japanese internment, it has a longer history, because he actually supported, California efforts to, restrict Japanese citizens and, everything like that. And so maybe just talk a little bit more about that. You use the phrase in the book, concentration camp. Talk a little bit about all of that.
I got some pushback from people that were referees of the book and stuff on that. And I stood pretty strong, and I had the backing, ultimately, the Independent Institute of saying, no, I want to use the term concentration camp. One good reason, the best I can think of offhand, is that's the term FDR himself used. He called them concentration camps as late as 1944. Now, by saying that, I want to make clear that I'm not saying these are the same as German death camps. I'm not saying they're anything like them, but they are concentration camps in the kind of textbook way. They got guard towers. People are shot if they try to escape. You've got a barbed wire. You've got all of this. And how do you get in them? It's different than the German and the Italian Americans who are interned. And I'm not justifying that. I think there were abuses there. But you are interned purely on the basis of ancestry. And you live in the designated area, which is where most Japanese are, the West Coast, basically. They're even putting kids from orphanages who have Japanese ancestry, born in the U.S., in camps. There's nothing quite like that, I would say. Now, FDR's background, he is often portrayed as, it's bad. Now, that is the... no one will defend it, but then they would kind of mitigate it by saying, the polls are so overwhelming. Pressure is so overwhelming. And he's distracted. First of all, I find that there's all sorts of problems with that, because FDR is not a distracted kind of guy. He knows what's going on. He's in touch. He's got good advice. He's got people opposing this. And his own attorney general opposes it, for example. The early polls in February showed little support for this idea, very little. Only after it was a fait accompli, you have polls showing it. The initial attitude of the press is sort of like they're American citizens, leave them alone. So there isn't a great groundswell. And again, it occurs 2 months after Pearl Harbor. Now, the backstory is that in the 1920s, FDR was an op-ed writer for the Macon Daily Telegraph. And in that, he wrote articles saying California's right to ban Japanese immigrants from owning land, it is right to ban interracial marriage, and it is right to, you know, stop Japanese immigration. And then in the late 30s, he makes a private comment in a cabinet meeting. I think it was in a cabinet, but anyway, it's well documented, where he says, look, if we got a war, have a war with Japan, any Japanese American who had met a Japanese ship, you know, and fraternized with Japanese sailors should go immediately into, his words, a concentration camp in the event of war. So FDR is this bold leader, right? We're in a, he is in a lot of ways. He knows what he wants. He's not distracted. This isn't a different FDR. So he's willing to do this. Is it because he's motivated by a hatred of the Japanese? Probably not. I think it just isn't an issue with him. And that's part of the kind of callous aspects to him. He does it, or he allows it to happen. He enables it. And he has opposition, his attorney general, his secretary of interior, and FBI director Hoover. There's a long list of people who are against this. Advisors, close advisors of FDR, including people in the military. There's no internment in Hawaii where more Japanese live in terms of 40% of the population. Why? Because the military commander there, basically, one reason is he's able to stop it through foot dragging. FDR wanted to intern the Japanese Americans in Hawaii and send them to one of the smaller islands. And it was pointed out to him, and eventually he relented, but he pushed it hard, that that was going to be, we're going to be taking ships from places like Midway and bringing them to transport these people to... and eventually, I mean, they back off, but he's persistent. He wants to do it. And he writes his executive order in such a way that he can intern Japanese Americans in Hawaii, but they end up not doing it, but largely for practical reasons. And there's pushback.
I want to actually push this issue about the cruelty. I mean, it's there's a, you know, ex post, ex ante kind of issue that we might want to sort of nuance the discussion about. But I used to teach an honors course here at George Mason University undergraduate, and it was sort of on the economics of deprivation. And we studied, you know, basically the 20th century problems of extreme oppression regimes. Okay. And so obviously the Holocaust becomes a major aspect of that, but given my own background, I also stressed a lot the gulag and other kinds of things as well. But I made the students go on a trip down to the Holocaust Museum. If you go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., which I recommend to everyone to go do, you know, as you enter in, you know, you're struck by the images right away. But on the wall, right as soon as you enter in on the first floor is an exhibit. I don't know if it's still there, but it used to be an exhibit on the plight of the voyage of the St. Louis, which was a ship that left from Hamburg, Germany in 1939, carrying about 900 Jewish refugees to come to the United States. And they went to various different places along the eastern shore. So not just the United States, but I think they tried to get entry into Cuba maybe or somewhere else. But the United States was a main, you know, port of entry. And Roosevelt denied their entry. And eventually this ship had to be sent back to Europe. It went to, went back to Holland, actually. But about a third of the ship perished in the Holocaust in the camps. What was FDR's relationship as you went through all this stuff with regard to the anti-Semitism and other kinds of issues that were sort of such a major part of the history of the 1930s?
There's a very good book on this that I've just started, and I can't remember the title offhand. I misplaced it. It's here somewhere. But it's about Rabbi Stephen Wise, who was a key Jewish leader, pro-FDR, and but you know, was trying to get him to do more and really tried to defend him. But it goes into example after example after example. It's devastating of opportunities FDR had to help Jews for example, most of the years you could have let more in under the quota, for example. There were places like the Virgin Islands, he could have let them in, you know, given like a, he had broad executive power to do things like that. Places in third countries, there were a lot of examples of things that could have been done. And is that cruelty or is that just, maybe I'm using the wrong word, but I think there is a cruel side to FDR. And I give you examples of that on other topics, but it's sort of, it's just not a priority for him. So there's a cold-blooded nature. I kind of lost your question there, if you could go back to it.
No, I mean, this. I'm trying to, it goes back to the earlier question about why it is that FDR, you know, still gets ranked so highly compared to, say, other presidents who engaged in sort of, you know, racial preferencing ideas, like someone like Wilson. But FDR seems immune to any of that, you know, in an unusual way, because there's this inability to help the refugees and send them back to this horrible set of circumstances is significant. But it's also the case, like you point out, the sort of inattention to the plight of African Americans, you know, that should be more well understood and known about FDR. And so, again, maybe bring out some of that.
Yeah, let me first of all say, why doesn't he have a bad reputation? Well, he's got a lot of political luck. For example, I think the economy is getting a little better in 1936. He's able to sort of win on that. He uses government money very effectively. He sort of has good timing in a way. And then the war comes along. And again, we could question that the war got us out of the Depression, but it did certainly eliminate the unemployment by, you know, drafting people and that kind of thing. So he sort of has a lot of luck. And I think FDR, you said before, is a very charming man. But he always has deniability. He's very anti-Trump, right? In the sense that I think you could say there are similarities between them. Very much. I'd be happy to talk about that. But Trump just blurts out stupid things, right? If he doesn't like somebody, he'll call them a name. He'll be very explicit about it. FDR is a kind of charming guy. And if you listen to some of his speeches when he's attacking people, he does it in a kind of very effective, good-natured way, right? That it's very hard for you to refute. Now, if you want to get a sense of the what I call the cruel, cold-blooded aspects of FDR, you got to look at things like, which surprisingly have not been looked at as much as I would have thought, like the autobiography of his own attorney general, Francis Biddle. You've got to look at sources like that where they'll tell, here's what was happening at cabinet meetings. Here's what was happening in private conversations. And then you get that aspect to him come out. Interesting example, I guess you'd say, of cruelty. There was a guy named Joe Patterson. He was the publisher of one of the leading newspapers in the country. It was the New York Daily News. Millions of subscribers. I think it was the leading paper. And his sister, Sissy Patterson, had the Washington Times Herald, which was right up there, about the same. Big papers. Well, they'd been FDR supporters consistently, supported him in 1940, but they turned against him on Lend-Lease. And then after, they were very against his foreign policy at that point for about a year, less than a year. Then when the war comes, Patterson goes into FDR and he says, Mr. President, these were old friends. Gone to school together, I believe. They were friendly. They were first name basis. And he said, I'm here to help. Anything you need. You know, he was willing to volunteer because he had military experience and, you know, still relatively young guy. And FDR just looks, you know, ignores him. And then he finally says, Joe, I want you to reread all those editorials you wrote and then get back to me. And he says, and tell Sissy to behave herself. And then Patterson leaves and he's just like mad. He says, you know, I'm going to outlive that bastard, that asshole. You know, he's like really mad the way he'd been dissed. And even FDR's close advisors, the most ruthless people you could name, said those two had been friends for many years. He's offering his help. FDR's, you know, own sort of cruelty is getting in the way of the war effort. Here's a guy that's willing to back into the hilt, to get back in the fold. And he doesn't He doesn't want that. And so, you know, I mean, that's a typical thing in a lot of politicians, but I think you see that kind of thing come out sometimes.
Can you talk a little bit about one of the chapters in the book on the sedition trial?
Yeah, this is very timely. And when I started writing this book, I could not have imagined how timely it was, because sedition trials had kind of gone out, you know, I mean, they weren't, you wouldn't see them anymore, really, you know, when I started writing this book. But now they've come back, and they're as equally problematic, I think. And you had very unsavory people being prosecuted then, and as you do often now, but you have other people sort of caught up in it. And this is one of the biggest trials in the history of Washington, D.C. They bring in 32 defendants under the Smith Act, which is an anti-sedition law. And the defendants are accused of promoting insubordination in the military, right? And what you got, you get some guy that has an anti-Semitic newsletter in rural Nebraska, right? Some 80-year-old. And you got somebody else. Most of these people are kind of anti-Semitic, not always, but they're sort of in that cranks, right? And you bring them all together and they don't even know each other. And they're prosecuted as being part of a worldwide Nazi conspiracy to promote insubordination in the military. And the government, it was clear after a while, had no case. This was a chaotic trial. Each one of these people had their own lawyers. It was a mess. And the press turns against it, which had been supportive. And it says this is like the Moscow show trials. And it ends because the judge drops dead, probably because he couldn't take it anymore. And the government just gives it up, just drops the whole thing. But partly because there is massive pushback. There are all kinds of people doing things that people are not willing to do now. I don't like these defendants at all, but I don't like the use of the sedition law like this. Problem with sedition law is you could do a public choice argument here, whatever. It's open-ended. What's sedition? What's domestic terrorism? There are environmentalists now being prosecuted for that in Memphis or in Atlanta for really dubious reasons. Why not prosecute people for destruction of property, for vandalism, for violence? But when you have a sedition, anything goes, because there's no definition. There's no definition. And that was the case then. But the difference between then and now, because I think right now that is a mistake, is there was pushback from the left. A lot of civil libertarians said enough is enough. And people like Norman Thomas and mainstream people. But people aren't willing to raise questions. And I would say that's true for conservatives, too. There's a domestic terrorism prosecution, as I say, going on in Atlanta. None of them seem concerned about it because all the people are environmentalists who are being prosecuted.
Actually, it is a kind of, I just want to, you know, this is not necessarily a central theme, but the difference between the ACLU when you and I were a kid and where, you know, people on the left stand today is a lot different, right, in terms of the protection of our civil liberties. What do you think is the reason? How would you explain that?
Well, first of all, the ACLU wasn't perfect even in World War II. They had factionalism. They didn't do the job they should have done, right? But they did do something, right? And you had some very strong civil libertarians in the ACLU. I think World War I was big for these people. They looked back on that as a very negative experience of the Palmer raids and all of the violations of civil liberty. I think Prohibition was very big. They looked back at the government's enforcement of that, the trampling of constitutional rights, privacy. And they're using the term privacy, by the way, all the time. A lot of conservatives see that as something new. Right of privacy is being talked about by these people, left and right. And so they are inclined, a lot of people on the left, you know, if they went through law school, that they read a leading textbook by Zachariah Chafee, which was very pro-civil liberties, very pro-free speech. They come out of that experience. That's recent experience. So I think the legal fraternity, including a lot of them that made their way into the Justice Department, are pretty pro-civil liberties. So Roosevelt, this part of my story, is getting pushback from within the federal government a lot more than we've realized. A lot of He's different than Wilson. Wilson actually got pushed back in the other direction. Wilson would often, these people would often, like Palmer would go hog wild, and Wilson said, well, wait a minute, do you really have to do this? And they say, yeah, I do. And Wilson say, all right. In the case of World War II, it's often where FDR is pushing more and more violations of civil liberties, and he's getting pushback from the Justice Department, who really prevent it from going as far as it could have gone. So it's a bit, so it makes FDR look worse in that sense than Wilson, I think, because he's an initiator. He's pushing it. He wants to do a lot more than was done. And that's part of the story as well. He wanted to go after people like Patterson, even though after Pearl Harbor, they were supporting the government. He wanted to go after them because of their pre-war opposition to his foreign policy, which is a big difference.
Well, I think that this will get me to the, you know, one of the last questions, which is your book does a great job of documenting how it is that the Roosevelt administration utilized the power of the state to try to silence any of their political opposition. And this it has a direct bearing on the kind of world you and I came out of, because they went after the, you know, the anti-New Deal right in a very strong way. And you, in your conclusion, talk about the anti-New Deal groups being targeted and forced to even come and testify in Washington, D.C. For example, the Foundation for Economic Education and Leonard Reed. And so, you know, that history might be something a lot of the younger people that, you know, have still visit the Foundation for Economic Education website don't know. And so maybe you could talk a little bit about that and, you know, what Leonard Reed saw as the opportunity from that adversity and how he, handled himself and all of that.
Yeah. And if any of us know anything about, you know, if you've read about who were the libertarians at the time, they figure in my book. They're you know, taking a pro-civil liberties position. People like Albert J. Nock, H.L. Mencken, Frank Chodorov, Hoyles. You know, you find a lot of these people are players. But after World War II, a lot of this stuff continues for a while. There is an investigation of sort of anti-Fair Deal, anti-New Deal lobbies in 1950, which is during the McCarthy era. So there's some interesting overlap here in what's going on in investigations. And one of the people that is called, groups that is investigated, is a very new group at this point, like 3 or 4 years old, the Foundation for Economic Education, a libertarian group still very much around, led by Leonard Reed. And Reed is, you know, not sure what to do, because some of his friends are saying, you got to tell these people off. You got to go in there and refuse to cooperate, because they're asking for all this private information, like lists, names of people who are contributors and things. Reed chooses the route of cooperation, but he goes in there and he's so upbeat and he's so friendly and he's so effective that the chair of the committee, who's out to get him, sort of says, well, I think you're right. Your group is an educational group, you know, and it ends on this kind of positive note. So it's an interesting story where Reed, I guess, is a cooperates with the government, but he does so in this way where he uses it as a forum to actually promote libertarian ideas. Because they ask him, the hearing is great. They're asking, well, how do you promote ideas? Why are you doing this? What are you objecting to? And he just makes these logical, very reasonable answers about how they're trying to affect the internet, the intellectual climate, the kind of thing we would have read, you know, from IHS or Hayek, that kind of thing. So it's an interesting story about, you know, someone that is very familiar to us, if you know anything about this period, in a group that is very familiar to us.
You mentioned John Flynn as well, which is one of the books that, you know, I, of course, was exposed to as an undergraduate when I was first learning these ideas. And I didn't realize, again, it's similar to Hayek's Road to Serfdom, the power that the Reader's Digest had in being able to take these books and blow them up in magnitude by boiling them down to their readers. But maybe you could talk a little bit about what Flynn's main thesis was and why that was such a an important counterweight to the narrative that was going on?
Flynn is a man of the left who becomes much more conservative libertarian in a lot of ways. And he's there during a very, very difficult period. But Flynn does this book called As We Go Marching. I think that's what it's called, which is a book that should be read. You know, if you're reading Hayek or you're reading Rand's work during that period, comes out about the same time. And he's very prescient in talking about how there's aspects of fascism. This is kind of a subversive book that you see in the American government, but he does it in a kind of soft way. He does biographies of FDR as well, which are very good. He comes out of it from the left. Flynn had written for, I think it was New Republic or Nation for many years. So he retains that. He's against Japanese internment, interestingly enough. Well, okay, Flynn does this book. What is it called? I can't remember it now. But it's a book about the rise of the British, sort of focuses on Fabianism. And he's sort of warning about Fabianism and creeping socialist ideas and how they're spreading and that kind of thing. And the book is republished, an article, parts of it, in the Reader's Digest, which is, I think, the number one circulation magazine in the country. So they get these critics of Flynn. They're saying, these ideas are everywhere. You go into the dentist office, they're stacked in, you know, they're everywhere. You can't avoid them. And they're really, really worried about what Flynn is doing. So there's this group that underwrites Flynn, and they investigate them, this lobbying committee, and they're trying to find out who contributed, right, to these, who bought the books, because they were bought in bulk. So they try to get lists. And ultimately, this effort is challenged successfully in the Supreme Court in a landmark decision. The court says, no, that's surveillance of the press. You're violating freedom of the press. So the court actually, including the two main liberals, including Black, including William O. Douglas, they make a very civil liberty, pro-civil liberties decision, basically saying this effort to get names of contributors and that kind of thing is unconstitutional. And that is used as precedent for a landmark civil rights case where there's an attempt to take the membership of the NAACP by the state of Alabama and intimidate people. And the court just basically cites this case and said, this is intimidation. You want the names so you can publicize them and make them look bad. This is all very familiar to us today. So I point out these connections here. For modern liberals, big L liberals, they're going to see a lot here of connections to issues they think are, you know, important and figures they think are important. One of my heroes is A. Philip Randolph, for example, civil liberties hero in many ways. So, you know, there's a little bit of a different angle here that I think I urge people on the left to read it, and I want them to read it to take me down. Maybe I shouldn't say that. But I want them to read it to think, this guy's got to be wrong. I want to defend FDR. I'm going to look at this book, and I'm going to see what he says, and I'm going to track down his sources, and I'm going to look at this. Because I want that. And we become so segmented that I'm only talking to people that would be much likely to be more sympathetic to me. And I want to be interviewed by people that, you know, that are not sympathetic. You know, that we're so segmented. People just don't do that anymore. And that's unfortunate. And people used to do that a lot more, I think.
Well, I hope you get a chance to do some of those interviews. I have one last question, which has to do with the four freedoms. So you have freedom of speech, freedom of religion. Is it freedom from want? And then freedom from fear.
Freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from fear, and freedom from want. I believe I got that right.
Right. And so this is the Four Freedoms campaign. It's a major aspect of Roosevelt's marketing. It has, in many ways, stayed with us as the rhetoric of that time. Why do you think that has become so impenetrable, given the history that you lay out in your book? The history that Amity Slays lays out in her book about the economic consequences, the history of economic research, on the 30s and 40s. It's just a very, very hard nut to crack in some sense.
Well, you know, what's interesting about that is FDR rarely talked about the Bill of Rights before that. It was not a big issue with him. He didn't trumpet it and really got some pushback. I talk about there was a mayor that was an ally of Roosevelt named Mayor Haig, who was using just stormtrooper tactics, breaking up rallies, expelling people. He was mayor of Jersey City. And FDR got a lot of criticism because he didn't denounce Haig. He eventually had to kind of make a half-hearted criticism of Haig because he was getting pressure from his left flank because Haig was very anti-union. So you get, FDR's got a lot of pro-union people, leftists mad at him. So in some ways, the Four Freedoms speech was kind of FDR saying, hey, I am a civil liberty. You care about that? I care about that too. And he gives this speech. Of course, as he gives the speech, as I point out, this guy named J.B. Martin, who was this black Republican leader, is in exile out of Memphis. He can't even go back to Memphis. So I said, well, one wonders what he would have thought of, you know, when he heard this speech. But it's been, it's sort of rewritten the legacy of FDR in a way, but he was not a guy that was that into civil liberties issues. But he framed it in such a way, at such a time, because this is right before the war, or the U.S. involvement in the war, U.S. intervention directly, that it just has been picked up. And he kind of captured the issue, but it was not his issue. And of course, the Japanese internment came after this and other things.
You know, I have one last thing, which is, are you working on a new project right now that you would like to let people know about?
Yeah, very, very much forthcoming soon. Me and Marcus Witcher, we did an edited collection of articles that Rose Wilder Lane wrote for the leading black newspaper during World War II, where she's trying to promote laissez-faire ideas. Yes, she uses that term to her black readership during World War II and linking it to the Double V campaign and immersing herself in kind of black history. And this part of, and she wrote like, 150 of these things, weekly articles. That part of her legacy has been kind of forgotten. So we were able to get all these, we were reprinting them, and I think people will enjoy it. And that should be coming out later this year.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. That's a, I don't know if you know this recent book by Naomi Oreckes. And Conway is her co-author on The Big Myth. And it, you know, goes after Leonard Reed. And, you know, it's in the same genre as her earlier book on the Merchants of Doubt or the McLean book on Democracy in Chains. This is a book about the big myth and how laissez-faire and Rose Wilder Lane is one of her targets that she really goes after and tries to, smudge. You know, her character and everything as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's sort of the theory that all these ideas are just sort of invented or something like that. And of course, I did a book on tax revolts in the 30s. I assure you that these ideas were around, right? And had popular sway. And there were a lot of people that were, you know, anti-statist, anti-big government and that kind of thing. So, but I need to look at that book on my list, I guess.
All right. Well, thank you very much, David. This has been great. And again, I wish you the greatest success with the book. It's The New Deal's War on the Bill of Rights. It's published by the Independent Institute. And, you can find it at the Independent Institute, Amazon, wherever, right? So,
yeah, you can find it anywhere, but independent.org. I'm sure they'd appreciate direct orders, but anywhere you can get it.
All righty. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.